Okay, so it's a great pleasure to give this talk. It's a little intimidating to be after Tony Leggett and Michelle, but I hope you might still enjoy it. So Michelle explained a little bit of basic questions of what does superconducting circuits have to do with the question of macroscopic quantum coherence and macrorealism. And I will really be somewhat more practical. I will just explain you a particular example of a circuit that displays quantum mechanics, and it's relatively fresh. And hopefully this will stimulate some discussion towards the macroscopic quantum coherence and macrorealism. And of course, I must apologize that it's going to be really only introduction to that because the time is limited. Let me just maybe to summarize what you learned on Tuesday. There are maybe two ideas that I wanted to stress. So first is that in experiments to confirm or violate the theories of microrealism, there's one problem, is that there is no alternative theory for quantum mechanics. Therefore, it's not exactly clear how to design an experiment that would definitely test whether you know quantum mechanics of large objects actually does not exist, and there is some other theory. For instance, it's not really clear this violation of microscopic quantum mechanics at macro scale can be a very tiny effect, and the circuit will be almost quantum mechanical, but there could be some little difference, and we don't really know which parameter of the circuit would be really most sensitive to this difference. You see, it could be the total mass of the circuit, number of free electrons, number of protons, quarks. It could be just simply how many H bars of action the system undergo in its quantum oscillations. Could be its size, the magnitude of currents. You see, if the oscillations correspond to currents of nanoamps or amps, is that important or not? And therefore, all we can do in this program is to investigate quantum mechanics at macro scale is simply to build devices with very different parameter ranges and see how they behave, see if we find something. And in doing that, there is the second thought, which is also very important, and it's not very often emphasized in the discussion of MQC, is that the experiments must really aim at the highest possible signal-to-noise ratio. Because, again, if the deviation we're looking for is very tiny, we might just see that you see a cat just oscillates just like an electron, and we would not really spot some tiny effect that actually says that indeed there's some difference in quantum mechanics of large and small objects. And this is basically the main challenge and drive of our field. We basically try to perfect our control and our measurement abilities of the superconducting circuits, and maybe I'll have time to give you a flavor on those. So to be more specific, what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to present you a summary of basic experiments on this new superconducting circuits that we called fluxonium. So we've came up with some sort of way to compare it to an atom in a periodic table, because it really behaves a little bit like an atom from a periodic table. And so Michelle explained the part ium that we think it kind of looks like cesium, magnesium, or lithium atoms. And I think today I will try to explain the part flux a bit better, so that you understand what's so special about this qubit is. And after presenting some experiments, I'll try to really teach some Josephson circuits to people who don't know what a Josephson effect is. And I think the beauty, sort of one reason that I think the systems are macroscopic, is that you can actually do this experiment indeed without knowing that much about Josephson effect. Which maybe means that indeed the motion of electrons or Cooper pairs in the superconductor is not that relevant. And if time permits, which I don't think it will, I was going to explain a little bit of this non-demolition measurements, which is really, really important part of this macroscopic quantum coherence program, because not only you need to create a system that behaves quantum mechanically, but you also need to be able to measure it. And it's really the measurement that is the basic problem of experiments. But we'll see how it will go. So I will do the talk upside down. Instead of first explaining what we're looking at and all the physics, I will first show you the data, and then hopefully I'll get you interested to actually listen on the physics behind it. So what we're talking about is that we have this a silicon chip, and we microfabricate a structure on it, just like it happens in regular electronics. So Michelle already showed some of the images. So let me just explain what it is. So what you bright is aluminum, and the dark in different colors, unfortunately, is silicon. So it's a high quality silicon, the one that is often used in microelectronics, and the high quality aluminum. So what you see is that there's a loop. And the loop is interrupted by junctions, and I'm going to show you in more detail what a junction is. It's coupled capacitively. You see there are these fingers. They kind of not touching each other, forming sort of a two-dimensional capacitances. And it's coupled to these wires. And if you zoom out, you see that these wires are actually very straight. And then if you zoom out even more, you see that they kind of form a snake. And this is a transmission line. So a microwave signal, basically a signal corresponding to voltage between these wires or current in the wires, could propagate. And it's chosen in such a way that the length corresponds to some frequency of interest. So all frequencies in this in our field are microwaves. There are two reasons for that. First, it just happens that superconductors have really energies in the microwave range. H bar omega is approximately 1 Kelvin, and it's really a convenient scale to work with. Another reason is that microwaves is really the workhorse of telecommunication. It's the best. It's basically one of the best ways to transfer information. And since we're trying to manipulate and read quantum information, we might as well benefit from the classical information tricks, which have been vastly in the microwave domain. Okay, I'm going to explain you actually how this circuit works, and hopefully it will not indeed require any superconductivity knowledge. But since it's a circuit, and since we're talking about quantum mechanics of circuits, I decided to draw indeed how this chip transfers into an electrical circuit. So basically, what you see is a one-to-one correspondence of the image to the circuit elements. So this inductor is over here. It's made out of junctions, and then this small junction is over here. So Michelle explained that we denote it with a cross for some historic reasons. And basically, both objects can superconduct currents, so we're getting a loop. And so this is this loop. Now the junction comes with a capacitor, basically because it's an overlap of two aluminum films, and it's this parallel plate capacitance that we denote like this. So you can only see some sort of tiny spot over here. Now these two guys we represent by one capacitor. You see this loop is capacitively coupled to something. And okay, here there are two capacitors for symmetry, but in a circuit you can essentially ground one end and use only one capacitor. Yeah.
Naive question, but what I don't understand is if you have superconducting material and you create like a typical capacitance geometry, does that necessarily imply you have a Josephson junction, or do you have to add something else to get the Josephson? Can you just have a pure capacitance material?
We'll get to that on the next. We'll you see, I've prepared some sketch of what a Josephson junction is, and okay. I think I'll answer your question. So right now we're just really just looking at the circuit and identifying its elements, and then we're going to look at the elements in more details. So now this snake is basically can be very nicely represented by an LC circuit, and you can at least convince yourself that it's not too wrong, because you see if you try to see if it can short circuit DC current, you see that it can, because the current can start here, then it continues, and then over here you see the two wires connected, so it comes back, and you see this can happen through this inductor. And at the same time, if you sort of thinking about, if you know a little bit of propagation of waves and transmission lines, you see what happens is that here there's a short circuit, but for some one frequency that basically corresponds to quarter wavelengths of this path, over here is going to be transferred into an open circuit. So this is called a transformer. That's sort of a basic trick of electrical engineering. And you see this can be represented by a parallel combination of LC, because when omega L equals to 1 over omega C, essentially the impedance of this circuit is infinite. It looks like an open circuit. Basically, the current in the capacitor interferes destructively with the current in the inductor, and so there's no total current here. So this is the kind of basic electrical engineering reasonings that we use to understand these circuits. And then there is another bigger capacitor. Now, this is this capacitor that isolates already the snake from all the true real-world wires. You see these guys, which really go to the measurement electronics. They're very classical, very dissipative. And basically, this is, we think, is sort of the minimal setup that allows you to probe an atom without killing it. Okay? Ignore for now all these numbers. They're sort of made for experts, and it's we're really just interested in images. Now, so to answer Joseph's question, I decided to make a sketch of that image so that we can actually see what is what. So, okay, sorry. This is the snake, okay, really just two parallel wires, nothing special. So let's look at the loop. So this is the loop, and this is sort of a close-up on this central region. So you see how the junction is made. So there are two layers. There's a thin layer, then there's a green butter, and then there's a thick layer. So, and what happens is that you see the top layer is evaporated through the same mask as the bottom layer, but a little bit shifted. So that what happens if you try to track the flow of the current, for instance, over here it can flow in both thick and thin layer. Over here, the thick layer is broken, so it can only go through thin. And then in order to get onto this side, it has to really go through that green stuff. You see? And this green stuff is what makes the Josephson junction. It's essentially a very thin layer of an insulator. And so to answer your question, you see this insulator has to be really only 1 nanometer thick. So if you just bring two pieces of superconductor close by, there's not really going to be any, they're not going to really know about each other. Essentially, they could not support supercurrent because they're simply too far. So, but if you really need to bring them really, really close, but still insulate them with an insulator. And so it's really 1 nanometer. That's why, you know, we call that this is nanofabrication. And really the quality of this oxide is really determining the coherences in many types of Josephson circuits. Okay? So...
It's basically like a capacitor, but with a very thin insulated
layer.
Exactly.
It's a very fancy capacitor, you see, because this oxide is so thin that electrons cannot go through it, but the Cooper pairs, the interacting electrons, they can. So that's why this doesn't work with normal electrons.
They basically tunnel through.
Yeah, they tunnel.
And
yeah.
So nanometers, so it's just like a few, maybe 10 atoms thick.
Yeah, it's the way it happens is that that's the reason why we use you have to use aluminum, because it just happens that when you put some oxygen onto aluminum, it forms some layer of oxide exactly a few nanometer thick, and then it stops. And so it really basically it's a very metastable object. If you have too little of this oxide, there's going to be a short. So just regular electrons will go through, and it's not interesting. Or if it's going to be an open, there's not going to be a Josephson effect. So it's a really, really metastable system, and it's actually amazing that it produces qubits. It's very dirty if you look at it in a microscope. So speaking of microscopic effects, yeah, this is another important comment is that we can apply flux through this loop. And what happens is that this loop has certain properties, and flux can change those properties. And these properties is basically that it responds to electromagnetic radiation in exactly the same way as an atom responds to light. You can basically do one-to-one experiments, and what this flux does is basically some sort of analog of a Zeeman effect. If you place an atom in magnetic field, the transitions, they start to change as a function of field. So basically this is our control knob, and it's very convenient because you can just glue the coil on top of your chip and simply dial voltage on a voltage source, and that's going to change the states of the atoms. So this control is very important in the study of macroscopic quantum coherence, because you have to be able to see if the behavior that you see sort of can be changed in a way that is consistent with that or another theory. Yeah. Right. So, in theory, if it's just a basic Josephson effect, there shouldn't really be any dissipation, because you see, Josephson junction, it really conducts current without dissipation, and if this oxide is perfect, even if even at high frequencies, it would still not really absorb. Electromagnetic radiation. If you want an array, there is no a priori reason why an array should be worse than a single junction. Now, there are a lot of experimentalist worries, because you say, well, I'm really having this hard times building a qubit out of one junction, so what if one of the junction is bad? Then the whole array is screwed, if you want. And well, this doesn't seem to be happening. If you want, this is actually the first experiment on a coherence in an array. So, if you want, we don't really know why it works that well. So, if you just write a Hamiltonian, you know, if you're just a naive theorist, you say, oh, okay, well, yeah. Why would you get dissipation in Josephson circuit anyways? But practically, we're surprised that it's not really dissipative, and. We yet to find out. You see, if you believe in quantum, in for instance scaling of qubits, you have to believe that the circuits consisting of many junctions would be coherent. And essentially, if you cannot really overcome skepticism of making an array non-dissipative, you should drop quantum computing with superconducting circuits. So I find that the fact that an array actually is no worse than a single junction is very encouraging. It's one of the first proofs that you can really have hope to build circuits with many junctions. Okay. Now there are several ABC wisdoms about this circuit, which we might not have to emphasize, but let me just tell them. So, array really is designed in such a way that it acts as a giant inductor. So Joseph asked last time if we just try it and see if it works, so we can calculate it. So the answer is you can calculate it, and basically that's what we did. But we did not know a priori if that's going to work, because again, this is the first time you actually make an array. So make an atom out of an array. Okay, arrays have been made, but not quantum coherence for quantum coherence applications. If you want, the total inductance of the array is a sum of inductances of individual junctions, which basically come from their other properties that you can measure, for instance, resistance at normal at room temperature. Now, the second a wisdom about this circuit is how you actually look at it. So what happens is that you see we have some sort of transmission line which is terminated with a short on one end, so when a microwave bounces, it basically comes back with a phase shift of pi, you know, the same effect as when something is bouncing out of a metallic mirror. And over here, you see it's bouncing out of this loop. And what happens is that depending on the quantum state of this loop, you know, think of the loop as an atom, it has different transitions, different states. If it's in state 1, you know, the microwave reflects with some phase phi 1. If it's in state 2, microwave reflects with some state phase phi 2. And what happens is that since the total resonance frequency is basically given by this boundary condition, the resonant frequency of this line now depends on the state of the qubit. Now, measuring resonance frequency of a resonator is very easy. You basically try one, see the response, try another one, see if response is bigger, and find the maximum, and that's basically it. So then you can stop at the maximum and excite some other state and see if it's no longer maximum. You see, that's basically, this is also, by the way, how the time metrology is done. You basically watch if some circuit is out of resonance with something or not. And the third, maybe most important one, which is not so often discussed, is that the reason that we decided to look at the qubit by looking at the frequency of the resonator is that resonator actually protects the qubit from our measurement operators. What happens is that measurement operators is essentially an amplifier. An amplifier is, for engineers, is essentially a resistor, and then there's in some way voltage is measured on that resistor. So it's basically dissipative. If you want it, it shines quantum noise that basically relaxes the atom. And what this resonator does, you see these 50 ohm lines, these wires, they're not really connected directly to the loop. They're first connected to this guy and then to the loop. And so this guy acts as a filter. If you want, we can only the quantum noise that eats the energy of the qubit is getting filtered at all frequencies except for one that corresponds to the resonator's length, but the qubit is always at some other frequency. So that's essentially the trick. In quantum optics, you put atoms in a cavity so that atom more easily gives out energy to the resonator. And in electrical circuits, the atom is so happy to share its energy with all the environment that you basically have to instead forbid its talking to the environment. And so the resonator now is never matching the frequency of the atom, but always far away from it. Yet you can still see the atom because you can bounce microwaves that carry a phase shift without exchanging energy with the atom. So it's not a paradox. It does not contradict any Heisenberg relations. You can find out information about the system without exchanging energies with it. So that's basically it. And now, to get even more complicated, never mind the slide. I just need to go through it because it's supposed to be an experimental talk. But if it's too complicated, it's not really important for the rest. Essentially, so let's condense now all this into a box. Even though there are sort of two access ports, in reality there is only one. It's again sort of a symmetric drawing. And so at the end, we have our atom in a cavity. It's on a chip, and there is one sort of microwave connector sticking out. So we have a black box. We can apply field to this black box, see what happens. But basically, we have only one port. Now, so what we do is the following. So we have this green generator that can shine light at the input. It passes through this roundabout that is just by the IQC. And it's this magic device is called circulator. And you see what it does? It basically does what these arrows show. If the wave comes from this side, it lets it to the left, but not to the right. And then if the wave bounces off the box and comes back, just follow the green arrow. Then it actually goes forward, but not to the right. And exactly the roundabout. And this way we can sort of apply a signal, let it bounce, acquire some phase, which is the information about the atom, and then get into the amplifier, get amplified. And now what we get is that at the output of this triangle, we have essentially a microwave at the same frequency as over here, but with a different phase. And that phase encodes the state of the atom. And then what happens next is some technical thing. These microwave frequencies are very, very high, so it's very hard to kind of detect them. So what we do, we mix these two frequencies together, which is basically a multiplication, and then what comes out is essentially a signal that has zero frequency. It's sort of a constant voltage, but it's entirely given by this phase. And then it's digitized. So basically this part, sort of starting from the mixer, you can this cross, you don't have to worry about. At the same time, we can apply another tone that is supposed to now talk to the qubit, and it can excite the qubit state. And what happens is that as we apply this pink tone, the green tone changes. The reflection amplitude for the green tone changes. We can further maybe explain it using this diagram. So imagine the atom is prepared in its ground state, which is zero. And let's then let's scan the frequency of the green generator around the cavity resonance frequency and see what comes out. And what's going to come out is this familiar phase curve for a harmonic oscillator. Okay? Now imagine that you've prepared the qubit in another state, in the one state, using this pink generator. You have to shine a frequency, you know, that corresponds to the transition of the qubit, which is never really matching the transition of the cavity. And what that does is that shifts this blue curve into pink curve. Okay, so the cavity has a different resonance frequency depending on whether qubit is excited or not. And if you, for instance, measuring the phase, you see if you were measuring at this frequency when the qubit was in the ground state, you measured, you know, phase this much, and then when the qubit got excited, you're measuring that much. So you see there's a phase shift. Again, this is the basic experiment on atomic clocks. That's how you keep track of whether frequency of the cavity has changed or not. So if you want, this part is not really very quantum. It's sort of a way to figure out what's the cavity frequency. The quantum part is that how an atom actually moves the frequency of the resonator. Okay, so let's now look at some data. What you see here is a transition spectrum of this particular atom. You see the first two transitions. So this axis is essentially the frequency of the atom, and this axis is the flux that tunes these transitions. Okay. So usually atom. You see. It's very funny. So usually when they try to show transitions of the atom, we usually draw that. And there's basically only one axis. And in artificial atoms, we always draw transition as a function of some knob parameter, something that changes them, because it's really the dependence of the transitions on some external parameter is what gives us the confidence that we understand the atom. And so in this case, it's this magnetic flux through the loop. Each time you have a loop geometry, its properties are periodic in flux. Each time the flux goes after flux quanta, the property repeats, so you see something periodic. And basically, this is the spectrum. So you can think what kind of atom does that remind you. For instance, let's go over this transition. So we're going to come back to them at the very end of the talk to understand what this actually means and how it is connected to the MQC phenomenon. But basically, there's this zigzag transition, which is excitation from the ground state to the first excited state. And then there's this yellow transition, which is an excitation from the ground state to the second excited state. So what you can see is that at least that the transition spectrum is highly unharmonic. So Michel was explaining that with a harmonic oscillator, you're really in bad shape to do quantum mechanics because it always tends to respond in the correspondence limit as a classical object. And really, you must have your levels not equidistant, and basically this is it. There are some effects. For instance, there's a transition like that, which is crossing this one, and we might discuss it later. This is essentially a manifestation of cavity talking to the atom. So if you want, this is a transition of the cavity, and it doesn't depend on flux because it's just a length. And you see this transition is basically a copy of qubit's transition elevated by the cavity frequency. So when you excite this, you at the same time excite both qubit and the cavity. So it's, if you want, it more reminds a molecule rather than an atom over here. But basically this is nothing special. So I just wanted to essentially show you that it works. We can also... Now, very important point. By just showing this spectrum, I can't really prove I have an atom. Because imagine I have a... Yeah. Yeah, yeah, this is... Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah, what happens is that it's actually impossible to show raw data because you would not see it due to pixelation problems. You see, there's a huge frequency range, and the atomic transition is so thin that if you try to show some sort of 2D plot, you basically would not spot the lines. So what we did, we extracted the transition frequencies and plotted them as the circles and then put black lines as a theory. Okay? And basically in the rest of the talk, I wanted to really explain what this spectrum means. But just before turning to that, I just wanted to make this one point. By showing this sort of transition spectrum, you can't really argue that you have an atom, because imagine you have a set of harmonic oscillators which are interacting with each other, and somehow their frequencies could be tuned with, again, some external parameter. What you will see if you try to excite them resonantly, you will see that, okay, at some particular frequencies, the system is responding more than at others. So you would see some peaks, and then if you extract, you can get, you know, the lines like that. So how do you know that this is not a harmonic oscillator? Well, you need to, again, remember that if you try to drive harmonic oscillator, you basically look for some quantum behavior. So the best way to do this is to see if we can make a superposition of state 0 and 1. And this works actually very nicely. So if we essentially apply a certain pulse, which is called an NMR as a pi over 2 pulse, we can create a superposition of 0 and 1 state, and only look at the red curve. there's too much stuff. And then what happens is that since the superposition state is not an eigenstate, it would oscillate, and you can detect these oscillations, and this red curve is a manifestation of this oscillation in some sort of stroboscopic detection. In fact, it oscillates much faster, but because it's so fast, we have to sort of undersample it, if you want. And it provides essentially a coherence factor of 100,000, so which we found very, very impressive for superconducting circuits. It's basically the state-of-the-art number. But it's really an atom. You can indeed prepare a superposition states of this weird 50 junction superconducting loop. Moreover, you can go further and do it between state 0 and 2, and basically see exactly the same effect. Again, let's look only at this Ramsey interference. So indeed, we prepare 0 plus 1, and we leave it on its own. Yeah.
I don't know if all the students know what a Ramsey interference
is. I know. That's exactly. Sorry. You see, I erased it here. You see, there's no Ramsey here, but then there is here. I was supposed to erase this. The point is that I think everyone knows that if you have eigenstates and system is in an eigenstate, it stays there. But if it's in a superposition of the two eigenstates, it has to evolve. And this evolution will produce a time-dependent periodic signal that you can detect in the experiment. And that's essentially the basic method of probing coherence. And what we see is basically, this is a result of an experiment like that. We prepare a state 0 plus 1, and watch what happens. We don't do anything. We just wait and then measure. And what we see is that it oscillates. And essentially, and then you can do all kind of tests to prove that this oscillation is not something spurious. They really depend in the right way, for instance, on the frequency of the qubit. For instance, yeah.
Does it depend on the flux through the circuit?
Yeah.
So you can tune the frequency that way?
Yeah, there you go. Oh, sorry.
Well, I'm getting ahead of you, I guess.
You see? That's the dependence of frequency on
the
flux.
Level, right,
in fact, you have that's a sort of another important comparison with real atoms. You see, in real atoms, they emit an effect, okay, you can split maybe by 100 megahertz an optical transition, okay, maybe more, I don't really know very well. But you see, you can completely revert the level structure. So you see here you have a very low frequency transition and very high frequency transition. So you start with a spectrum like this, okay? And then as you go here, it's sort of the opposite. It's very high, and then the next one is very close. So you end with a spectrum which is more like that. Okay? And all what it takes is basically applying 4 volts of voltage somewhere at room temperature. Okay? Okay, so... Just to summarize, this weird looking circuit actually shows some of the best coherence, and is very very promising for multi-qubit applications. Now, because of lack of time, I won't really show fully with it, and actually switch to the sort of question more related to this course, is that how are these experiments relate to the questions of macroscopic quantum coherence? And to understand that, we basically need to examine really what are these, what happens when we shine these transitions? What happens with the circuit? Okay? So, more specifically, what is special about fluxonium states compared to other states, and are they more macroscopic than others? So, now we're going to be doing some pendulum physics. Essentially, the problem in superconducting circuits is that, you see, formally what we have is just an inductor, capacitor, and the junction, and then it could be terribly complicating to actually figure out what happens, because you really need to know what the Josephson effect is. We've been thinking very hard and found actually a full mechanical analog of this circuit, which you see only needs a pendulum and the two springs. And basically, I'm going to explain the level spectrum that we have seen using only this model. So relax about Josephson effect. If you want, the Josephson junction is a pendulum. So each time you have a Josephson junction, you need to imagine a pendulum, but you need to figure out the right way to connect ropes to it and push on it. So just maybe still few comments. So capacitance is always like a mass. Basically, big capacitance means a heavy pendulum. This inductance is a spring constant. So essentially, large inductance means very soft spring. This is maybe one not very easy to remember comparison. A large L here means a soft spring here, and this is important. And then the flux through the loop actually is imitated by offsetting the position of these supports. Okay, and we're going to get into more details. Okay, so let's look at the ground state. So what happens is that we choose the lengths of the ropes in such a way that that basically if you do nothing, the springs are not stretched, so they don't have any energy stored in them, and the pendulum is just looking down, so there isn't any energy in it either. So this is the ground state, and I call it zero turn state, and this question of turns is very important. We're going to discuss it now, but this is why there's E0. Now, just to sort of explain this awkward mechanical structure, what happens is that if you rotate pendulum clockwise, one spring stretches and gets energy, but what happens is that this rope, because you see it's not a rigid, it basically just gives out. We cannot really compress the springs. We can only stretch them. That's the reason why there are two of them. In principle, it could be a one-spring circuit, but because we could not find out how to compress a spring with a rope, you see, you cannot push, you can only pull. That's why there are two springs. And so essentially, if pendulum turns clockwise, one spring stretches, counterclockwise, another spring stretches. That's it. Let's say now that the pendulum has made one turn like that, okay? In the situation where, if you want, the gravity is pretty heavy and the spring is sufficiently soft, what's going to happen is that by making a turn, we're gonna stretch this spring by essentially length, which is 2 pi times this radius, okay? But nothing else will happen because essentially the pendulum will still be kind of pointing down. There is some energy over here, but it's not really enough to visibly push on the pendulum. Okay, and this is a one turn state. You see the pendulum made one turn, and you know about it. You see you've made a one turn, but you can count it because the spring got charged with tension, and so it's there is some energy. It's small, but it's still finite. Okay, and we can write its energy as you see. This K is a spring constant, and then R square. Okay, I hope this is clear. All right? So, any questions? Let's see what's a minus one turn state. Let's basically flip it the other way around. Now what happens is that it's this spring is stretched, okay? And it's stretched by exactly the same amount, essentially. It has exactly the same energy, okay? So states with one turn and minus one turn are basically degenerate. Now here's when you turn on quantum mechanics and ask, can you have tunneling between those states? You see, this is a state with a sort of one turn. This is a state with minus one turn. You see, they're different basically by which spring is stretched, but they're stretched by the same amount, so they're degenerate. And classically, this process is forbidden because what has to happen is that if you start from here, the pendulum has to, by itself, do two turns. At the end, we have conservation of energy because the initial and final energies are the same. But someone has to really bring it above the energy barrier. And it's really these states that we study quantum coherence between. Now let's go further and say, okay, does it really have to be two turns? Can we do it just with one turn? Because, you know, two turns seems a little too much. Okay, so just to sort of strengthen our intuition, let's consider two turns. So two turns means I'm going to do one and another one. So now it's stretched by twice times 2 pi r. And so the energy is now four times bigger. Okay, this is just to sort of say that the energy is quadratic in number of turns. Now, okay, is that... now, why I'm so excited about it? Because it means it's unharmonic, okay? The states between zero turn, one turn, and two turns go as one, two, four, nine. It's a highly non-harmonic spectrum.
How does quantization show up in this mechanical system? Is it the number of turns?
Yeah, this quantization, you see, is a completely classical effect. It's simply that you make essentially a system with some topological property that it counts turns. It has nothing to do. It's a little bit like quantization of charge. You see, it's not necessarily a quantum effect. You can just have balls or quantization of flux in a superconducting ring, which is basically the effect that I'm trying to describe with pendulums. You see, the fact that a superconductor traps flux in discrete units is not a macroscopic quantum effect. It basically can be derived from the motion of Cooper pairs. Okay? Thank you for this reminder, because it's very important to know that this quantization has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. The quantum mechanics enter when you allow transitions between different end states. Now, that's where it's really quantum. I guess it's just the problem of word quantum. It means two things, you know, just discreteness and something very bizarre, which we're discussing today.
So, why are you excited by the fact that we have an amp?
Right, so, sorry about that. No, it's very simple. So, harmonic oscillator, if you try to drive it, you see, if you drive it like that, nothing happens because it's off-resonant. If you drive it like that, you will excite this state, but then there's no reason why it should not go there, 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 and there. And you see, you kind of don't really see the discreteness anymore, because you cannot really bring the oscillator in some given state. And this is manifested, it's very nicely discussed, for instance, in Feynman's book on the quantum mechanics, where he explains that any system with a quadratic action, which is a harmonic oscillator, will never behave quantum mechanically. And this is basically it. Okay? Now, right. And just one comment is that, okay, this increasing n cannot happen to infinity, because at some point you stretch the spring so much that despite it being soft, it still accumulates so much energy that it will now basically won't really like the pendulum to move at all. It basically will be balancing it, and then these free turns would no longer be allowed. This could be understood for those who know at least a little bit of superconductivity, is that an RF squid can only trap finite number of quantas of flux. and this is essentially manifestation. There's n, if you want, our system breaks at some point, and this is its breaking mode, when you stretch it so much that the energy, the elastic energy, is now comparable basically to the barrier to overcome for the pendulum. Okay? But we're only interested in n basically being 0, 1, and minus 1, so it's absolutely practical. Now, what about tunneling between the neighboring states, basically no turn and one turn, because it looks like it requires least amount of non-classical motion, so it could be better observable. So then we have to introduce this this flux through the ring, or in our language, we're going to have to basically move the position of the spring support. Let's see what happens. So let me explain this picture. So this guy just stays constant. We don't touch it. I did it. I should have had this arrow a little bit over here. So we only push on these guys, and what happens is that let me offset this support by an amount which is okay. This P is supposed to be pi. So let me offset it not by 2 pi, which has been happening after one turn, but only by pi. So you see that charges this inductor with some energy, but it's still less than the energy that was in this situation. You see here we would here when the pendulum makes a turn, it stretches by 2 pi r. What we're going to be doing now, we're going to be stretching it ourselves, not with the pendulum, but by pi, by half of that. Again, because the spring is soft, it's basically not going to do anything to this pendulum. It's just going to get stretched, basically. You know, it's going to obey to the stretch. Now, pendulum has a funny option. Now, if it makes a turn, it can release release essentially. You see, when it makes a turn, it has essentially 2 pi of length to release. And what happens is that this spring will get again on stretch, but this will get stretched by exactly the same amount. Okay? Now, I don't know if this is clear. It kind of took me half an hour to figure this out. but it's really just imagining this pendulum turning. And the point is that now, if you apply this sort of offset to the position of the spring, you're making states with basically n turns and n plus 1 turns degenerate. Now you have this configuration where pendulum didn't do any turns, but this spring is stretched. With this configuration, where pendulum actually did one turn, and now this spring is stretched. Okay? So again, the two energies are the same. They're 4 times lower than the energies in the previous case because the spring is stretched only by a factor of 2 less. So the two energy states are 4 times lower, but still you need to overcome or do one turn by a classically forbidden process. Okay? So, that's what this is supposed to mean. And basically now I'm ready to explain what does it mean in a loop. Well, basically it means exactly the same. So we have this loop. This is an inductor, junction, capacitor. Let's ignore this pink for now. Using the coil, we can apply this offset flux. And essentially, what I called number of turns for a pendulum in this loop is called number of quantas of flux that live in it. Superconductors, the superconducting loop can hold flux in integer units, and then if this loop is interrupted by a junction, this flux can change and this is this tunneling, okay? And and this tunneling is characterized by this energy, is usually called ES, and S stands for the slip, because this process is this, you see, if you want, on oscillator sleeps, the pendulum sleeps and makes a turn, so something similar happens here, so that's why this ES. But so I just wanted to make clear this plot of energies of this loop, because you see, I just explained that the energy of the nth of the state with n turns in the pendulum basically goes not as n squared, but n minus this offset. Okay? Let me know if this is not clear, because basically this is the central point. You see, let's maybe just quickly go back. So you see, so E1 is an energy with one turn without an offset. But if I have an offset, I additionally stretch the spring, so I have to add this over here. So N essentially counts number of turns, and every turn basically gives me a quantized stretching of the spring, but then I also offset it, okay? And what this makes, And what this makes is that, you see, energy is quadratic in N, but it's also quadratic in the offset. And offset is a continuous variable. So if I plot as a function of offset these energies, I'm going to get parabolas. Okay? And every parabola is shifted in X direction by an integer. Okay? This is basically the key plot. So you have, for instance, this parabola corresponds to zero turns or zero quantas of flux in the loop. And then the next one corresponds to one turn of a pendulum, one quantum flux in the loop. This is minus one, etc. And of course they cross. So you see, this is the crossing between minus one and zero. This is the crossing between one and zero. This is the crossing between minus one and one that we discussed. So you see, the two degenerate energies here are four times bigger than here. Of course, when they cross, if quantum mechanics works, they're basically going to split. And this splitting is exactly the coherent tunneling between these two states. And in our experiments basically aim at detecting these splittings.
Color, is that still real data?
No.
Okay, I thought that was too good to be true.
No. Well, but we'll get to compare it with the real data right away. So maybe you'll still be impressed. We'll see. So just one more sort of thing is that, you see, if I try to observe now transition between blue and red, I've plotted them here. So you see, right at this value of flux, I'm just going to get, you know, some small number which is here, and then it goes linearly with flux, and it's just a property of subtracting two parabolas which are shifted. You see, the square term cancels. So the if you have if you subtract between the two parabolas, you're going to get shifted parabolas, you're going to get linear transition. And basically, you see this, you're getting this zigzag curve, this purple one, and this is essentially a signature. If you see it in an experiment, this is essentially, the only way to explain it is that you have this charging effect with, you know, turns, you have quantized turns, so Cooper pairs, this zigzag is very hard to get in any other way. And So déjà vu. So basically, this is the zigzag we're getting. Here I guess you can't really see much. This is the raw data. But so if you zoom in over here, you see this avoided crossing, and this is exactly the splitting between states with one flux quanta in the loop and no flux quanta in the loop. And as you go away from this spot, it's basically really straight. It's really the subtraction of the two parabolas. And then, you know, it continues. It's even more cool if you look over here, because what you see is that it still continues up almost like a straight line, at least in small range of fluxes, so which means that this is a splitting actually between minus one flux on state and plus one flux on state. So it actually does do two turns. And you can still see quantum tunneling between effectively pendulum actually doing two turns. And this is slightly renormalized, but the physics is like that. Now, of course, as you go, now what happens is that as you go away, you see you're getting deviation. So let's look again. Here we're just supposed to see straight lines. Okay? Here we see straight line up to second transition, because then it's getting deformed. And basically it's getting deformed because the spring is not sufficiently soft, and essentially takes over and starts to essentially ruin the turns. But at least the quantum tunneling between one and two turns are really, really is really, really there in the spectrum, and this is the interpretation of what happens. So I'm almost done. So we're doing good. Yeah.
Can you explain this little zoom in? The data was that's all
this one.
Green.
This one.
The background.
Sorry. Okay. So the way this data is taken is, as any spectroscopy is taken, you basically, you know, measure some signal that somehow tells you if the qubit is excited or not, as a function of some parameters. So you change this parameter and that parameter, and what happens is that when qubit is not excited, you're measuring all the same value, which is now encoded in pink color. And then when something is wrong, this value takes this measurement quantity takes a different value, and here it's blue. And so what you see, if you look at it from the top, you basically see a chain of mountains which basically show you a transition. So the width of the mountain is the width of the transition, and we prefer to plot it as encoded in color. And so the pink is basically the background, is the signal when qubit is not excited, and the blue is when it is excited. Now, the reason that you see dots is basically noise. So, you know, there's some variations. But
So the dots of all these measurements are not the dots?
No, there are these dots, yeah.
You're saying?
Yeah.
Because not noise.
Well, it's technical noise. It's not quantum noise. It's basically when you measure something, it measures with noise, and it's basically that noise. It's not projection noise or quantum noise. It's just the fact that when you simulate something, you get a number when you measure this number. So, yeah.
So what's being measured is like the height coming out of the board or the screen, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. In order to get the frequency, you need some intelligent being that say, "Hey, I see a feature." So okay, that's the resonance, and then you extract the point. Usually this plot is simply given as this big pink background and some structure, but the problem is that this is the first superconducting qubit which spans the scale from basically few hundred megahertz to something like 15 gigahertz, and you simply don't have fine enough pixels to see it. So this is another sort of amazing thing about this qubit. Like usually you see in papers a piece of data like that. You see you have only small range of frequencies and control parameter, but you can really just plot it like this. But in our case, we really have to hide the raw data from you and process it so that it's visible. Okay? Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
At which point did you get your very high Q1?
Ah, good question. So, pretty much everywhere. So what happens is that you see, it's a very good question. When your frequency is close to 8, that's where the cavity is. Then you tend to emit into it stronger. So basically, you're not getting any large values of coherence time here. But the moment you go away from this bad transition frequency at which, if you want, your qubit is open to the measurement lines, then it's basically completely independent. And it's large, essentially, pretty much everywhere. There are some variations, but it's clearly not limited by the measurement apparatus. And another thing, okay, maybe I should mention this, but actually, this yellow transition has a very large T1 because it's a forbidden one. You see the circuit at this value of zero flux, there's some symmetry. You can see it. And the symmetry forbids yellow to decay directly to the ground state. It has to first decay to pink and then to the ground state. Now, decaying to pink, you see, involves emitting a very low frequency photon that basically there are not that many options to absorb. And therefore, this yellow transition, even though it's pretty close to the bad transition of the cavity, is actually very long-lived. So you can really do the atomic physics magic with this qubit. this long, yeah, yeah, sorry.
Can you explain the numbers in the top right corner?
Thanks. So, okay, I'm really bad at chemistry, but as far as I know, when you look at the periodic table, you see three numbers. So one of them has got to be the A number, atomic A number, another one's supposed to be atomic Z number, and the third one has something to do with the difference between number of protons and number of neutrons, but I really don't remember. But basically, the point is that this qubit is characterized by the three numbers, which is essentially the inductance of the array or the energy, inductive energy of one flux quanta, by the Josephson energy, and by the capacitive energy. And these numbers are basically those numbers extracted from the experiment. They are not discrete, they are continuous, and that's basically the beauty of artificial atoms versus real atoms, because these numbers are actually continuous. Yeah. So the transmon actually has only two numbers. So, roughly speaking, it's pretty close. So, I can answer your question more precisely. So, in the transmon, you don't have this number, 0.5, because you don't have this array. The transmon consists of a junction and a capacitor, and so. In our case, it's 2.5 and 9, and in their case, it's more like 0.5 and 20. So the biggest difference of this atom from the transmon is this third number, which highly renormalizes the spectrum. But in that sense, they can really, and I think they did that. Essentially all superconducting circuits could be represented by these boxes, and. Okay, so 5 minutes. I think I'm going to be on time. So, any more questions for now? So, since Tony Leggett was here, he must have been talking about that. So let me explain this. So, this splitting between zero and one number of turns or number of fluxons could be represented by.
Sorry, I don't understand that, actually, if you don't mind. Are you saying that the x-axis is supposed to correspond to something physical?
Here?
Why are you calling this a splitting? Because there's just one line there. That's the ground state. That's the 0 to 1 transition.
Yeah, that's the 0.
Right, okay.
Yeah, there's always this, you see, that's why I have these two plots. You see, you have states, which you never see in the experiment, and there are transitions, which is what you see. So you have to be able, basically, to subtract quickly. So this transition is, I think, what Tony Leggett called 30 years ago MQC. Now this phrase has a much broader meaning and cannot really be assigned to only one experiment. But I just wanted to explain a little bit what happens. So this splitting you can understand as a mechanical particle in a double well potential. If you want, in the absence of quantum tunneling, it would be basically vibrating either in one well or in the other well. And, you know, there's going to be some zero-point motion, and the wave function would essentially be either localized in one well or in the other well, and we can label them L and R. Now, when the tunneling, when you turn on the tunneling, what happens is that these two states are no longer degenerate. They're split by the process where the particle goes, travels under the barrier and comes back, and then and basically keeps doing that, which is pretty impressive for someone who doesn't like quantum mechanics. It's the fact that states could be in a superposition. Okay, it is somewhat impressive, but here you really have to admit that it somehow goes under the barrier and back. And essentially, when the two L and R states have the same energy, the eigenstates basically are symmetric and antisymmetric superposition. If you want, in order to account for this tunneling, you're going to have to lower the ground state energy by making it symmetrize L and R, and increase the excited state energy by making it L minus R. And In our case, we basically go from 10 gigahertz, which is approximately the vibration. It's basically like the size of this well, to half a gigahertz, which is really the splitting. So the point here is that the splitting is really small, so the tunneling is very weak. And the weaker the tunneling, the more impressive it is, because, you see, it's sort of deep under the barrier, but yet it still tunnels. And the way we kind of see what happens, I wanted to essentially present this experiment that I showed in the beginning again. So we start, if we do nothing, we start in the ground state, which is really the state where particle is delocalized, but it's L plus R, so it's a lower state. And then we can apply a pulse that will prepare it in a superposition of ground and excited state, which is basically L. Essentially, by applying a microwave pulse, you can essentially bring it into one well. Now, it's no longer an eigenstate, and so it's going to oscillate. And it's going to basically oscillate from L to R, L to R, L to R, and we can detect it. And that's indeed what we see. You see, we start in the ground state, prepare it in the left well, and it keeps doing that, and we see this oscillation. So this is basically the experiment that I think Leggett wanted 30 years ago, and at that time it was considered to be very difficult, but with the advances of understanding of Josephson circuits and measurement, it's actually pretty simple these days. So, and this is my concluding slide. So I think I did somewhat good job explaining what a turn is, but still, what a fluxon. So how do you visualize it? So we have this loop, and there are many junctions, and essentially let's label with circles the region between the two junctions. It would be sort of isolated pieces of metals which has to be connected to the rest of the circuit via this green stuff via the oxide, okay? So we call them islands, and there's going to be essentially the circles everywhere. So now let's draw this loop in a sort of more artistic way. Let's draw it as a circle, and as a big circle, and put these little ones as islands. And then let's indicate here a weaker link between these two islands. It's a smaller junction, okay? So you see it looks like a loop, and then it's almost closed. There's some sort of exit. Now, the state with zero fluxon, and Michel on Tuesday explained what a phase is. So phase is essentially an integral of voltage divided by a value of flux quantum. And so we can draw this phase as arrows. Okay, and the different arrows essentially show the fact that this phase can fluctuate. And what happens is that the zero fluxon state in our case is when all these phases are basically pointing down, slightly fluctuating, and then the phase on these two islands is fluctuating slightly more because basically it's the weaker link, and it's because of these fluctuations fluxon at the end leaves. Now, the way it leaves is the following. It makes this configuration where basically the phase, now this arrow make a full turn. You see the phase turns by 360 degrees from here and here. So you see it starts at almost zero fluctuating and then comes back, completes the full turn. That's where the analogy comes with a pendulum. If you want, the stretched inductance is equivalent to phase on these islands basically making a turn. And in our case, it's making really the full turn, and there's basically a difference between a full turn and not a full turn, and that's why a full turn configuration is called fluxons. So that's how you can visualize them. And basically, this tunneling that you see is a tunneling between configuration of the phase distribution on this loop, which apparently Tony found very impressive. Apparently because it really involves all the islands, sort of all the loop participates in it. But I can't really add anything more to the question of macroscopic quantum mechanics. Let me just mention that, so, okay, following these remarks, they're just a copy of my entering remarks, okay, we've found out a circuit with a vastly different parameters, and maybe it will indeed spot something. But up to now, it's just obeying to quantum mechanics with a very high coherence factors. And kind of curiously, we've seen these states corresponding to 2-pi turns have actually never been observed, because in the original proposal, it was extremely difficult technically. But here, it's just very easy. So that's it.
questions?
That was over there.
I mean, you said you weren't going to say more about it, but if I can ask you, how macroscopic? I mean, so how many particles? Is there any way of counting? I mean, you probably had a bunch of different ways of counting.
Yes, but you see. Yes, but you see, it's basically okay. So how many? Well, let's think about it. How many particles? Okay, 10^-many, because it's a huge size of circuit. So there's really a lot of particles. Now, which particles are important is essentially an unknown question. It's a question to someone who really understands. It's a question to someone who is coming up with an alternative theory, okay? Because you know that theory would somehow be more different from quantum mechanics or less different from quantum mechanics, depending on the value of some of those parameters.
So how about center of mass?
And what is it?
Center of mass of those whatever you want to call, I don't know, electrons, pairs, whatever's important that are in mind.
Well, you see, It's not a well-defined the concept. So all I can tell you is that what happens, so this is an exact answer, is the tunneling happens between these configurations. And if you want, all Cooper pairs must participate in making this configuration. If you want, if you break this circuit anywhere, it's not going to work. But for instance, the currents that are circulating are very small.
Could you talk about the energy difference between the two states?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So... maybe one parameter that really makes sense is not even energy, because energy is the same. It's the action.
Right.
So what is the action that you need to spend under the barrier? So in our case, it's 3 h-bar. And I think Tony argues quite often that you will never have 10^23 h-bar, because e to the minus 10^23 is something that non-existent. So you see already, going from 3 h-bar to 4 h-bar is a huge difference, because you see what's going to happen is that this transition frequency will get even smaller, and in order to observe coherence in it, it has to live longer than the period. So, for instance, right now, coherence, so you see the transition is about 0.5 gigahertz, so its period is, let's say, you know, like 2 nanoseconds. So, okay, if it's coherent, let's say, for 10 nanoseconds, we will see an oscillation. But you see, as you try to, let's say you aim at 10 h-bar, so then the coherence, then the transition frequency would be 1 megahertz, and now it has to be, you know, a microsecond coherence so that you can see it. So see, it becomes exponentially difficult. So in this circuit, it's 3 h-bar. In the flux qubits, for instance, it's something like 1 h-bar. So, but at least it's a well-defined quantity. And maybe 3 matters more than 1. Okay. So, or maybe, for instance, 10 is going to be enough, and then we can really aim at experiment, you know, doing 10. But I can definitely tell you that we're not aiming at doing 100 h-bar, because it's not going to work. In fact, the world record on h-bars is in Serge Haroche's experiment on photons in the cavities. There's basically a superposition between 10 photon states basically doing that or that. So.
When you see interference, yeah. Your photons, then there you have mini h-bar.
But what do you mean? What exactly?
Well, if you have the interference of a distant experiment, you look at where the fringe comes in, it's when you're about h bar action difference.
Oh, yeah. But you see, by that reasoning, you can say that a neutron interferometer also has many h bars. But and again, maybe that's actually the way to see. For instance, you make a big area, right? You're sensitive to something that's doing with this area, and maybe that's actually the way to go. And in principle, and by that reasoning, like a two-slit experiment or a neutron interferometer could be equally macroscopic in the sense that it sort of samples more area. So if you want, in that sense, exactly. But you see, since we don't really know which parameter is important. Okay, this is basically our shot on superconducting circuits.
In NMR, when you look at the free induction decay, you have millions of flips.
Yeah.
So if it's just each bar, or the action, then other places are better.
Yeah.
Systems are big, that's right.
Yeah, but it could also be H bar compared to combined with something else. You see, that's right. Exactly. So we don't know. We could only generate more novel circuits and see what happens with them.
Okay. Well, let's thank Vladimir again.